A young hijabi woman shared with us that she's had her hijab, people have tried to pull it off. The first thing I said was like, this is not your fault. We should not be living in a world where you have to look over your shoulder. We should not be living in a world where people have to, go through these trainings that we deliver in conflict zones all over the world. And the best thing that they can do is to keep themselves and those that they care about safe.
Hey, this is Epicenter NYC. We connect our communities to news, information, and each other. I'm your host, Curtis Rouser. Over the past few weeks, we've seen a spike in reports of harassment and hate crimes across New York City. We're hearing stories of assault from our friends and our family, from Jews, Muslims, Turban men, and East Asians. So, at a time when many of our neighbors fear for their safety in public places, including in schools, what are the best ways to stay safe? And how can we protect each other and our communities as a whole? Today, Epicenter's S. Mitra Kalita talks to Kaleya Ann Mendoza to answer those questions. Kaleya Ann is the Director of Mutual Protection for Nonviolent Peace Force, a global civil society organization. Kaleya Ann also hosts bystander training and community safety workshops across New York City.
I believe similar to you, over the last few weeks, we've been receiving both official examples and reports of hate crimes here in Queens, a young Sikh man, certainly some anti-Semitism. And then closer to home, I'll just share my daughter's best friend, who's a hijabi, has been the victim of at least three harassment incidents. And she's 11 years old. So that's a real life scenario. You know, my 11-year-old comes home and says, someone called my friend a terrorist. We told the guidance counselor, but now she's afraid to come to school. So I'm just presenting that scenario and wondering whether that sounds, I guess we should start with, does that sound familiar?
Yeah, I mean, like I heard that exact scenario, actually even worse, a couple weeks ago when we did a training in Midwood for the Muslim and South Asian community, a young hijabi woman shared with us that she's had her hijab, people have tried to pull it off. The first thing I said was like, this is not your fault. We should not be living in a world where you have to look over your shoulder. We should not be living in a world where people have to, go through these trainings that we deliver in conflict zones all over the world. I mean, like the US has always been in a conflict. Let's be clear about that. And first, really coming from a place of psychosocial safety and security, and like letting them know that this was not their fault. And the best thing that they can do is to keep themselves and those that they care about safe. And there's a whole bunch of ways to do that, but primarily first, taking that step and recognizing that as the survivor, this is not your fault.
Okay, that's really helpful, actually, as like a immediate response. Is there anything preventive? So if we know that the climate might be this way, when we are sending our children off to school, how can we arm them for that moment?
Sure. Some of the tools that we provide folks range from situational awareness to de-escalation to understanding your survival responses and survival tools. If it's cool, I'll just walk through them really quickly.
Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah.
So situational awareness, in essence, is understanding what's happening in your environment and what's happening within you. And when I work with youth, I always tell them, I was like, so if you ever go to like a party or some event and something's telling you that you need to get out of there, that's your situational awareness at work. Those are your ancestors telling you to get out of there. Your body's processing both conscious and subconscious information all around you. So that one is like really trusting yourself to understand what's going on in the situation. And that means being observant, not having your headphones in, not having like your head down on your phone. Unfortunately, in this time, folks need to be constantly practicing what we call the OODA loop, which is observe, orient, decide, and act. So there's practicing situational awareness, just very basically. Two, understanding your survival responses and survival tools. So survival responses is understanding if you're a fight, flight, freeze, or fawn person. So if violence happens to you, where do you go directly? And I personally am a fawn type person. So I know that I'll try to practice diplomacy or even people pleasing in order to keep myself safe. And what we train folks on is like, whatever has kept you safe is the correct response. Some people are like, I wish I was a fight person. I was like, no. You, your lived experience and your ancestors have brought you to this point to keep yourself alive and safe. And that's something that needs to be honored. So understanding your survival responses and your survival tools are informed by those. So there's two primary survival tools. There is the understanding your activation points. These are otherwise known as triggers. So once you know what those are, you know, if I hear yelling or anti-Asian sentiment, automatically I go into activation mode. And along with that, understanding your anchor points. What are the things that keep you cool, calm, collected, and connected within your window of tolerance where you can think clearly? Because a lot of times, whether it's in disaster preparedness or even being at a protest, understanding yourself is really the first key. And that will help inform how do you move forward, because you can only really de-escalate yourself and those you have a relationship with.
Yeah, that's so concrete and helpful, because it also is not the same answer for everybody. Some of us are looking for a formula. You're giving us a few formulas maybe, and that feels actually kind of empowering. One challenge is the overlapping nature of targets right now. So for example, some moms groups that I'm on are very worried about anti-Semitism and saying, should our children not have the Jewish star as a necklace? Should we, you know, our names are very identifiably Jewish. You know, what should we do? So that's one area of discourse. There's another, which is my children wear hijab, my son wears a turban. So there are these outward symbols that I think families are worried about. I just wonder, like, what your take on that is.
Yeah, I mean, that's an individual decision, right? But for someone that's visibly Asian, I haven't been able to turn off my Asianness the last 4 years. And I think what it calls us is to think about how do we build safety infrastructure that is community-led? Because Joanne Yu, the executive director of Asian American Federation, said when asked about, you know, having police in every community, it's like there will never be enough police officers to protect all of our elders, but there will always be community. So what does it look like for parents to have protective accompaniment going from, you know, from one part of the neighborhood to the school? This really needs to be like a community-led approach, because really community cares about community. That is the one thing that we've always found to be the foundation of safety, is knowing your neighbors, having that relationship, and building that safety infrastructure from the grassroots up.
Is there anything that we can outwardly do or show to foster that sense of community?
Some basic grassroots organizing 101, and just like bringing together a group of folks, whether it's, you know, moms, parents, other folks that are concerned, whether it's just like having your neighborhood block party, just to come together to check in with one another. So really starting from those foundations, and then assessing what do you need to build safety. This is something that we did in Minneapolis in the lead up to the Derek Chauvin trial, is actually being invited by neighborhood groups to help them, support them in the event that there might be wide-scale violence. So they're really starting from connecting with folks and understanding what are your capacities, what are your vulnerabilities, and what do you want to achieve?
One thing I found, I mean, a part of the reason that we're approaching the story kind of prompted by children, is because my own kids, I've noticed, have gone to their grandparents for kind of this like history lesson of America. Now, my parents cling to this belief that more people are good than bad. You know, when my daughter will say, we saw somebody say, go back to where you came from, right? Mm. And my father will say, there'll always be those people. But in my experience of 50 years in America, there's more people who want you here than not. Do you see a shift in attitudes, or is it that we're more aware of it because of social media and a climate that has maybe enabled some of the haters? I'm just trying to get some perspective as somebody who's immersed in these issues.
There have always been fractures here in the United States, right? Like, this country was built on the genocide of Native Americans, enslavement of Africans, and the exploitation of people of color. So it's, I think it's disingenuous to think otherwise, and to recognize that those fractures are there. So I've been talking to a lot of friends about September 11th, after September 11th, and what's happening now. And I remember being an organizer, I was like 20-something years old at that time. And The difference is that we are seeing in real time both the stories and the reporting of what's happening in Gaza. We have more information to work with, not just like the state line. That changes the dynamic in which how people are perceiving reality, right? Like, I remember September 11th, we were all God bless America. And there were very few of us that were like, hold up, my Sikh friend just got called a terrorist. And no one wanted to talk about that. We're not in that space anymore. And the fact that Gen Z and millennials especially have seen so much shift in just a few, you know, like a decade, I think that there is more trust in community and in one another than there is in the institutions that have been propping up melting pot kind of like framework.
Yeah, I think that's an important point, because I remember after, and so I was a reporter after 9/11 and very much was an uphill battle to cover. But I did. I covered, you know, hate crimes for quite a few years after 9/11. But there was also a, you know, like I remember some Indians would be like, well, we're not Muslim, so maybe tell people you're not Muslim. That was the approach. Whereas now, actually, I've seen Muslim people saying anti-Semitism on college campuses is not okay, full stop. Yeah. Jewish people saying this is not okay, full stop. So it does feel like there is a little bit more of what you're describing in terms of publicly standing up for the other.
We've moved from like a charity framework where it's like, oh, I'm going to help you because you're sad, to a solidarity one. Like, it may not directly affect me, but I know that if I don't protect you, then it'll, you know, this will eventually come to me. Or our community has a responsibility to care for one another. When as soon as October 7th happened, I knew that already Islamophobia was on the rise. I called like all and messaged all my Southeast Asian and Asian folks who aren't visibly Muslim or South Asian. I was like, y'all, we know what it's like to be attacked. We need to rise up for our siblings that are going to have to bear the brunt of this as well. So I think solidarity is no longer a buzzword. It is a practice that we're seeing everywhere.
I wanted to just, before we turn to bystanders, I wanted to just turn to you personally. You mentioned your kind of responses to Fawn. Is that something that was developed? Like, I just wonder if you can reflect on bullying or anti-Asian hate in your own life. What was your response and what have you learned from that?
At the start of this pandemic in April 2020, I was on my way to Hell's Kitchen for, I can't remember what for, but at that time, everyone had their masks on, right? There was one older white guy without his mask on, and he kept on looking over at me, and I clocked that immediately. And I knew that I'm going to need to move around him. I'm going to need to keep him within my line of sight. So as we approached 50th Street Station, I was going to exit as quickly as possible. He looked at me dead in the eye, spat at me, and called me a dirty chink. And my first response was like, oh, I'm sorry. And he kind of, I don't know what he was expecting, but hearing the, oh, I'm sorry part created that moment of pause. And I was able to get out of there. Looking back, folks are like, oh, I should have done this. I should have done that. Whatever has kept you safe and alive is a correct response. Yeah. So, yeah.
I love that because it really is. It's making me feel like in many of these situations, you feel like you want the right words.
Yeah.
Actually, you're saying centering your life and getting out of there alive is the right response.
Yes.
So simple, but actually most important thing, right? So I just wanted to shift to bystanders. One woman told me that she was trying to get a table at a food court. She got to the table. Another woman had wanted the table. You could picture this. And then the woman called her a chink. The conflict was about the table. The other woman, the white woman, brought race into it. So two questions. One, is your response to that the same as keep yourself safe? But then for the rest of us around that, do we have an obligation?
So yes, and safety is holistic, right? It's physical, it's psychosocial, it's all of the things. I think it's really a decision, and this is why we do training, so folks can actually embody and go through the process of understanding how they would respond. Some folks, like I know a lot of Asian women and femmes, that would be like, okay, let's fight. Other folks are like, I just want to get out of here. I think it's important, especially for folks that survive through violence, is to never second guess themselves. Whatever they need to do to keep safe, that includes like maintaining their dignity. If some folks need to yell and do that, right? There's no judgment. And I don't think people should feel like there's only one way to approach it, because it really is an individualized response, right? I think for bystanders, yeah, we do have an obligation, but also more importantly, I think everyone is wired to want to, you know, protect one another. There is only one reason that we've survived this long, is by building these communal bonds with each other. So I know for a fact that people, they want to intervene, but they just don't know how. And it always takes just one person to say, this is wrong, for other people to be like, okay, I needed to hear that, now I can move in. Because other folks are also put into a, they might go into freeze mode, they might not know what to do. I always tell people, the first thing that you do is you check in with the survivor and say, do you need support? And allow the survivor to dictate and to direct what that support looks like. An example of this is like a couple, was the last year, time is strange. I was on my way to this anti-Asian hate rally in DC, and I was in Moynihan Station, and there was a, I was just like waiting, and I heard someone yelling at this younger Asian woman. And immediately I clocked that she was like looking around everywhere for someone to help. No one was helping. Everyone saw, no one was helping. So my first response was like, oh my God, Christine, I'm over here. So immediately making a beeline for her, the person that was having a mental health episode immediately stopped and didn't know what was going on, because I yelled really loud and was like super sugary. And then I went up to this person. I was like, my name's Kala. I can walk with you this way. Let me know what I can do to support you. She was frazzled, but she was still like, okay, can you just like stay with me for a little bit? I was like, I'm happy to stay with you. Do you want me to call someone? We can move this way. So really moving through each step of how you're going to support is important. So number one, checking in and getting consent to support. Sometimes that might be like a, you know, just like a quick head nod. Number two, moving through each step of how you're going to support the person. You don't want to swoop in. That's more detrimental than anything else. And then really centering the survivor in terms of what their needs are. Do they need space? Do they need you to stay with them? And just make sure that they have what they need before you depart that situation. And anyone can do this. Like, everyone has the ability to intervene when violence happens.
How did you get into this type of work? What inspired you?
I always say my ancestors, because like I, ever since I was a little kid, I grew up in California, and we are immigrants to the U.S. and tomorrow was never guaranteed, and we always prepared for the worst, especially for earthquakes and everything else. And one thing that I always saw was, even in times of distress, it was a community that came together to protect one another. And I've always seen my social justice activism and my safety work as something intertwined, because this is the one thing, safety is the one thing every single person can get can agree upon. The ways that we get there are different ways, but for me, it's bringing in a collectivistic approach. It's bringing in analysis that looks at the underlying factors in terms of risks to communities. And lastly, it's about building community power from the grassroots up.
What did I forget to ask you? What do you want to make sure you get across?
That we are in pale and scary times, but I love the Mr. Rogers quote that his mother shared, is like, in times of distress, in times of disaster, always look for the helpers. There will always be helpers. Yeah. And I think if we see ourselves as not just, we are part of a collective, we are, you know, everyone is reliant on everyone else. And regardless of folks' identities, we all have a place in safety, just like we have a place in social justice and social good. So I want to just like invite folks to think about ways that they can show up for their community and themselves from a place of reimagining safety when it doesn't come down the barrel of a gun.
To quickly reiterate Kalea An's advice, some key takeaways. Make sure the targets know the hate is not their fault. Center your own safety. There's a place for bystanders, but we should always take direction from the survivor. To learn more, follow Kaleah Ahn on Instagram, linked in our show notes. There, you can also keep tabs on upcoming events, virtual workshops, and other resources. That's all for today. Thanks for listening. And thanks for supporting us as we do our best to support our community. We couldn't do it without you. For more stories like this, make sure to subscribe to our newsletter at epicenter-nyc.com. Our intro music is All the Pretty Horses by Kara Vika. You can find more of their music on their website, linked to in our podcast description.